One of the first things Michelle Obama did as First Lady was to dig up part of the beautifully manicured South Lawn of the White House and plant a garden, a vegetable garden. Today she's out with a book, American Grown, a kind of diary of that garden through the seasons. We joined her on a hot day last week for a little tour.
This is one of my favorite times for the garden, spring, because everything is bursting.
Tomatoes and tarragon, figs and rhubarb, the stuff of state dinners and family lunches.
We have our broccoli here. We eat lots of broccoli, lots of fresh greens and lettuces of all kinds. To my oldest daughter's unhappiness, snap peas, her least favorite vegetable. And we have so much of it because everybody else loves it. Here, help yourself. Taste it.
That is one of my favorite things. So.
Very sweet, which is what I try to tell my daughter.
Talk about sweet. Over at a picnic table, there's a dish of warm White House honey.
We have some honey from our bees, and you have to taste it, Renee. This is most of the honey that I use in my tea. This is one of my favorite snacks, the White House honey with some sliced green apples. It tastes like sunshine, doesn't it?
Mm.
And we also use it to make beer. We have a White House beer that is brewed with the honey. We usually pull that out Super Bowl time. So we
and that's
put it
legal
to
make beer in the White House?
We just can't sell it.
When you were growing up in Chicago, did anybody in your family have a garden at all like this?
My mother's mother, my maternal grandmother, used to tend a community garden. And I really didn't know that until I started working on this book and we started talking to my mom about stories. And she was like, oh, yeah, this is how we got our vegetables, because my mom grew up on the South Side. They were a working class family, big family, six brothers and sisters. And they couldn't afford to go to the grocery store. So there was a Victory Garden, and that's where they got their vegetables.
Now, the Victory Gardens were, of course, those gardens during World War II, vegetable gardens that people were really encouraged to plant all over America. And, in fact, it was deemed a patriotic act to plant
Absolutely.
A vegetable garden and eat the food out of your own garden, more or less right next to your own kitchen. And I gather that the last garden here at the White House was, in fact, a Victory Garden.
Absolutely. It was planted by Eleanor Roosevelt, one of my heroines. She started the whole movement of Victory Gardens, which obviously played a role in our thinking about this garden as well. We have a wonderful history in this country of community gardening, and somewhere along the way we lost that tradition. And part of what we hope to see is that people start reconnecting to that part of our heritage.
First ladies traditionally have a mission. And I'm wondering for you why healthy eating and combating childhood obesity was the thing that you were drawn to.
Well, as I share in the book, it's really a personal journey. I mean, before coming to the White House, I was a busy working mother. My husband was a U.S. senator. And was often not home. You know, we found ourselves eating out more than we should, the sugary drinks and, you know, doing the things that, the habits that you just fall into just trying to get through the day. And our pediatrician kind of pulled me aside and said, you might want to look at your children's diet. And up until that point, I thought I was good. I was doing, you know, I was pretty conscientious. We always worked out. But he was starting to see some trends that he didn't like, and he was a doctor working primarily in the inner city, and he shared with me what he was seeing in his practice, the increase of type 2 diabetes among his young patients, a higher incidence of obesity, and that was the first time that I was hit with the challenges of modern-day living.
By now, the First Lady is well known for her campaign, Let's Move, which is also about fitness, encouraging kids to get more exercise.
Kids aren't playing outside as much. The statistics show that kids are spending an average of 7.5 hours a day in front of some kind of screen, a TV, computer, what have you. Fewer schools are offering PE. Only 2% of high schools, public high schools in the country, offer PE classes. 2%. So slowly, our habits have changed to the point where it's jeopardizing the health of our children. And what I suspected was that most people were like me. They weren't paying attention, and they weren't trying to do the wrong thing. They just didn't know. So the hope when I came in was that we could start a conversation about kids' health.
Well, one of the things you've been campaigning for is getting more grocery stores into mainly poorer urban areas that have been dubbed food deserts. Mm-hmm. But a couple of recent studies just out in these last weeks, and one financed with financing from the National Institutes of Health, have cast some doubt on this idea of food deserts. I mean, they found lots of fast food places, but also supermarkets and produce stands in numbers that people really were thinking weren't there. I mean, as many as you might find in a middle-class area, sometimes more. And no link to obesity.
The thing I thought about when I heard about that is I'd love to take a couple of those researchers and drop them in several neighborhoods where I grew up and say, go get to a head of lettuce, one that's affordable, you know, that's fresh, and see what happens. You know, people are living in areas, there are areas near my home in Chicago where you have to get on a bus or take a cab. You know, obviously, if you're in the city of Chicago, there are grocery stores in the city of Chicago, but if you're a mother with five small kids and you're on a fixed income, the notion that every other day you're going to get on a bus or take a cab to a supermarket that may be 5 miles away, but you're carrying groceries and it's awkward and it's hard to do, that doesn't seem like the kind of accessibility that many more fortunate communities have.
So you're saying it's both physically out of reach and or too expensive or financially out of reach.
It's a little bit of
not to do with habits. Like the kids go into the store and there might be apples there, but they buy a bag of potato chips.
Well, in many of the convenience stores, there isn't fruit. But one thing we also say with this initiative with Let's Move is that there are many reasons why we're here. And food deserts and information and knowledge and exercise, all of those are a part of the solution.
Thank you very much for having us here.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time.
We joined the First Lady on the south lawn of the White House in her vegetable garden.
It is beautiful. I mean, here we are in the heart of Washington, D.C. We're looking at the Washington Monument, all that commotion out there. And that's the beauty of gardens. I mean, instantly you have an oasis.
Michelle Obama's book out today is called American Grown. And by the way, the White House garden and lawn are considered a national park. And author proceeds from this book will go to the National Park Foundation.
Now, our series, You Must Read This, where writers recommend a book they love. Today, we'll hear from Lauren Groff. She came across a book at a time of great anxiety when she was pregnant for the first time and scared about the future.
Staring into darkness, I wanted to read about happiness. I wanted novels that were full of joy. I asked my friends for suggestions, but heard in return only a drawn-out buzz of bafflement. In truth, books about joy are hard to find because happiness is nearly impossible to write about. Narrative thrives on conflict. And so, late one sleepless night when I stumbled upon Elizabeth in her German Garden by Elizabeth von Arnim, I felt as if someone had thrust open a curtain and revealed a window where I had assumed only the existence of a wall. Elizabeth von Arnim lived her life among writers. The short story author Catherine Mansfield was her cousin. She employed novelists E.M. Forster and Hugh Walpole as tutors for her children. She was the mistress of H.G. Wells. Her milieu was literary, but her first book is urgent and personal. Elizabeth and her German garden feels as if it rose out of von Arnim's deep internal discomfort with the way she was supposed to fit into her world. Still, what a fizzy drink this novel is. Framed as a series of semi-autobiographical diary entries, the book holds only the slenderest claim to novelhood in any conventional sense. It has very little plot. There are few characters, the narrator, a countess named Elizabeth on her isolated German estate, her three tiny daughters who speak a funny mix of German and English, her chauvinistic husband whom she calls the Man of Wrath, various buffoonish servants, and some visitors whom Elizabeth gently but thoroughly satirizes. There is also Elizabeth's great passion, the garden, which we see in its shifting seasonal abundance, from cowslips and kingcups to wild strawberries and rockets and azaleas to snowy fir trees. That is only the book's surface, however. There are great hidden depths in this narrative. Elizabeth is always comparing herself to the women around her and finding their socially circumscribed roles disappointing. Her happiness, when it comes, arrives as an act of will. Her delight feels hard-won, and it is dearer for her struggle. I wrote this from my own winter garden, where my babies were whacking one another with brown sunflower stalks. I credit Elizabeth for showing me a way through my darkest time by demonstrating that an act of focused attention can lift a person out of a long, dark spell. When the blues skulk near these days, I reach for my wry Countess Elizabeth. Anyone can get a little glow of happiness from living, even for a few pages, in her rapturous company.
That's Lauren Groff. Her latest novel is Arcadia. The book she recommended is called Elizabeth and Her German Garden.
We're going to learn now about how libraries are adjusting to the new world of digital books. Digital readers are still turning to their libraries. In fact, libraries have seen a surge in demand for e-book titles. But as Ben Bradford of member station WNYC reports, for libraries, digital books are providing both promise and problems.
It's pretty clear that patrons here at the Central Library in Queens want e-books. So last month, this became the first library in New York to start lending e-readers. 50 of the devices were preloaded with dozens of books each. Librarian Wanda Wright didn't even need to put up signs.
They went as quick as the customers came through the door, the e-readers was gone.
The e-reader program is primarily for people who don't already have devices or can't afford them. For those who do, the library offers thousands of e-books for download. Queens Library CEO Tom Galante says this is the library's mission, offering content in any form it may take.
We are the only place in town where no matter what your age, you can come in and access all the information that's available throughout the world, whether it's on the internet or it's on print.
Demand for e-books might offer some relief to libraries after years of budget cuts. Digital books cut the cost of labeling, shelving, and tracking physical books.
In Queens, we have over 70,000 books a day that we check back in and 70,000 going out. So in a digital world, there's considerable savings to libraries.
Fewer shelves could open valuable space for other library programs, like computer centers, teen tutoring, and adult education classes. For customers, downloading e-books is just convenient. Gussie Young has been checking out books at the Queens Library since moving to New York in 1963. Now with e-readers, she doesn't have to come here to check out books.
Well, I can do it right from my house. I can do it from my computer if I wish. Just hit the button, and it comes to your computer. It's a wonderful thing if you can find a book you want.
And there are no late fees. The book just disappears on the due date. But despite their potential, libraries are struggling to stock e-books. Most major publishers impose heavy restrictions or refuse to lend their titles. They're afraid that could undercut digital sales. According to the American Library Association, the e-book Eisenhower in War and Peace costs more than $100 a copy. Amazon sells it retail for $20. Here's Queens Library spokeswoman Joanne King.
If someone else has it, you have to wait your turn to get it, just like paper books. I'm sure there are some people who possibly will never get a chance at some of the bestsellers.
Another problem is that almost all U.S. libraries that offer e-books do so through an outside company called Overdrive. And libraries don't actually buy the e-books. They're, in a way, renting them. Here's Tom Galante, who runs the Queens Library.
When you license content through them, you really aren't owning the content. Every year you have to pay them to continue to have that subscription service, or you lose your content that you've already paid for.
If a library stops using Overdrive, it could lose all the books it's licensed through the company. Robert Wolven heads an American Library Association group that's trying to develop a new model, one that publishers would buy into and would eliminate the middleman.
These are questions that go beyond what we're doing now, what we'll be doing next year. We've talked about how we want to avoid developing the model for next year that's going to be obsolete by the time anybody gets to put it in place. And that's a real challenge.
For now, despite the limits for libraries, readers are still lining up, waiting to download. For NPR News, I'm Ben Bradford.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Cartoonist Alison Bechtel's first memoir came out in 2006. It was called Fun Home, and it dug deep into her complicated relationship with her father. He was a closeted gay man who poured his emotional energy into redecorating the family's Victorian Gothic home. Shortly after Alison Bechtel herself came out as a lesbian in college, Her father was killed by a truck, possibly a suicide. Now, that's a lot of information to take in, but it's essential in understanding Bechtel's new book, Are You My Mother? It's a psychoanalytic portrait of Bechtel and her mother, a relationship that is still evolving. Bechtel says when she sat down to write her new book, she wasn't intending to write about her mother.
I decided to write a book about relationships, and I was sort of interested in the philosophical idea of the self and the other, using examples from my own life, like from my own romantic relationships. But eventually it all seemed to, I felt like I was avoiding something. I was working on the book for a very long time before I realized that it wasn't making a lot of sense. I was trying to mix my life story with ideas about psychoanalysis that I was learning about. I reached a point when I realized that the real story here was about my relationship with my mother, and I had been kind of writing around that.
Bechtel's mother, who is still very much alive, is a constant presence in the book, commenting acidly on the narrative, even as it's being written.
She is not at all happy about the fact that I am exposing our family secrets and now specific material about her life. And that's a difficult ethical problem that I struggle with. Perhaps I don't struggle with it deeply enough, but I feel like, how do we decide how much of our parents' stories belong to us? My mom is actually really remarkable. She's understanding about this. Like, she hasn't forbidden me to do it. I know she's not happy, but she somehow recognizes that it's something I need to do, even though it's uncomfortable for her. We have a kind of uncomfortable truce.
Alison Bechtel says there's something, a kind of accepting warmth that she never got from her mother, who stopped kissing her goodnight when she was 7 years old. But in the course of writing the book, she realized something.
My mother taught me to be a writer at the point when she took dictation from me, made my diary entries for a brief period when I was 11 years old. I was in this sort of obsessive compulsive phase where I had to do all these repetitive motions in my writing. And so making my diary entries was taking a very long time each night. So my mom said, you tell me what to say and I'll write it down. And I feel like it was in that writing exchange, my words coming out of her pen, I think that's when I became a memoirist.
That's cartoonist Alison Bechtel. You can see pages from her new memoir, Are You My Mother, at npr.org.
Now, a new series about books for kids, specifically young teenagers. We're calling it PG-13. It's around 13 that young readers begin to crave the adult stuff. Even if they know they're not quite ready, they're eager for a taste of grown-up ideas. And for our series, authors will share the books that help them make the hard turn into adolescence. Here to kick things off is author Ben Marcus.
Adam Farmer is riding his bike. He's carrying a package for his dad, and he needs to get it to him fast. Okay, so far, I Am the Cheese by Robert Cormier is a perfectly harmless adventure story. But there's something weird about this bike trip. First of all, it's really far. Adam has to ride from Massachusetts to Vermont on a kid's single-speed bike. Can you even do that? He just started, and he's exhausted. Then, harder questions. Why is Adam alone? What's going to happen when it gets dark? This book made me worry. I was 12, and I trusted books. Their stories, the plots, and characters were straightforward. Had I heard of unreliable narrators? No. Did it occur to me that someone my age could be separated from his parents and have to find his way back to them? No. So I read it, and I worried, and I couldn't put it down. It became this nail-biter about my own survival. I was Adam Farmer. I was on that bike, and I had to get back to my parents. And then it gets worse. After every chapter, there's an interview with this creepy doctor asking Adam about his past. Adam tries to remember, but he's having trouble. And the questions keep coming. They're from some kind of government organization that seems to think Adam has a secret. If his name is even Adam. What? At this point, my mind was officially blown. Who were those people who visited his house? The doctor asks Adam. Who was the gray man who would only speak to Adam's father in the cellar? And what were Adam's parents whispering about when they thought Adam was asleep? Meanwhile, Adam's bike ride is getting harder. A dog gets in his way. His bike is stolen. The landscape feels like a nightmare. Is this really New England? Why does it seem like Adam is pedaling, but not getting anywhere? I don't want to spoil the end because I'm hoping you'll read it like I did all at once. trust me that the story only gets more urgent. And when you find out where Adam has really been riding his bike, you'll feel unzipped and undone and so blown away, you'll never read the same way again.
Ben Marcus is the author of the book, The Flame Alphabet. The book that launched his mind into new worlds is I Am the Cheese by Robert Cormier. At our website, you can find more PG-13 recommendations, as well as lists of summer reads from our critics and correspondents. That's all at nprbooks.org.